The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
This podcast has been sponsored by Juniper Square. Juniper Square is transforming the private capital markets industry with solutions and services that streamline fundraising, investment operations, and investor reporting. Designed for commercial real estate, Juniper Square is trusted by hundreds of investment sponsors to manage more than $1 trillion in real estate investments. Reach Juniper Square at junipersquare.com.
This is Mike Consul. Welcome to Author Spotlight. We're going to talk to a real estate philosopher today. His name is Bruce Statchenfeld. He is founder and chairman of Duval & Statchenfeld LLP, a New York City law firm, which has a high-profile real estate practice. As a lawyer, Mr. Statchenfeld has more than 30 years of real estate law experience, encompassing tens of billions of dollars of real estate transactions of all kinds. I think he's worked in every property type imaginable. He writes a biweekly column for AboveTheLaw.com. Its title is Power Niche Marketing, and he publishes a regular series titled The Real Estate Philosopher. And his new book is out. Available. Go ahead and grab yourself a copy. The title is The Real Estate Philosopher's Guide. And what is he guiding you to? The whole idea is a guide to real estate success. Bruce Statchenfeld, welcome to the program.
Well, Mike, thank you very much for having me on the program. I'm honored to be here. And I will do my best not to embarrass you and also to provide something useful to your listeners.
Oh, I've been a bit embarrassed before, but I'm thinking that you're going to spend a lot of time thinking about your navel because we're going to talk philosophy and real estate philosophy. Why is there a need for a real estate philosopher? Because when you think about it, real estate people think in terms of metrics. They think in terms of geography, markets, and submarkets. They think in terms of cap rates, and then looking at the comparables and the price they would have to pay, and so on and so forth. So what's the philosophical part of real estate investing?
So, okay, it's obviously a very good leading question. You know, what in God's name is a real estate philosopher? Why did he even come up with that name? And what does it have to do with anything? I guess when you get right down to it, my hobby, and it's been from grade school, I just like to think about things. My second favorite thing in the world is sitting by the pool with a pad and a pen, no iPhone, no wife, no dog, nobody else, and just thinking about things. And it's been my hobby. So
now you're in New York City, so you only are allowed to do that, 3 months out of the year? Like right now, you're not going to be sitting by the pool in your Speedo with a notebook, right?
Well, I admit I won't be in the Speedo, but I live in New Jersey. There's a pool. It's closed. And I might sit out by the pool. I just wouldn't be able to go in it.
You'd be in your jogging suit, your sweats and sweatshirt. Yes, okay.
It's a nice day out here today. But in terms of the what I'm actually doing with the real estate philosopher, you know, I was a philosophy major in college, and I like reading from people who are just smarter than me. And I could give you a good example that really answers your question perfectly. One of the people I like reading is a guy named Peter Drucker. Peter Drucker is world famous as the father of management as a science. And he really created it over about 70, 80 years. I think he died about 5 or 6 years ago. He's a professor at Stanford or something like that. And he just started thinking about what is management, okay? And then he wrote this wonderful book called Management. And in it, he comes up with all sorts of things, but I'm going to explain how what he wrote and how I apply this to the real estate world is as follows. Among other things, and it's hundreds and hundreds of pages, and every page is really sort of exciting to me. He asks a question. He says, what is the purpose of a business? And I remember thinking about it, you know, do good things for the world, make money, shareholders, employees, like all these things. But I really couldn't figure out what he meant. And now, because Mike, you do like to be embarrassed, I'll give you a shot. What do you think the purpose of a business is?
I think it's to innovate and employ people, to enrich societies.
Okay, interesting. I had similar thoughts like that. And that, look, that makes a lot of sense. It's logical and everything. But I'm going to tell you what he says, and I think you're going to tingle. I really do. And your listeners probably will as well, because it's so cool. All right, you ready? Drum roll.
Yes.
So the purpose of a business, according to Peter Drucker, is this: to create a customer. And let that roll through your brain for a minute. Think of the power.
I have to tell you, Bruce, Peter Drucker is one of my favorites, the late Peter Drucker. I think he was at Claremont College, not Stanford, right. Although he might have done some work at Stanford as well. But he, anytime I saw Peter Drucker interviewed or write anything, I read it because he was brilliant. And I love what you just told me. I wish I had remembered that from my reading of Peter Drucker. So, and he's actually the father of management consulting, right? I mean, I never thought of him as a philosopher, but he certainly qualifies. So go ahead.
So let me sort of, percolate on this a little bit. And yes, you're right. It is Claremont, not Stanford. But you think about what he says, just those few words, create a customer. He doesn't say go get a customer. Create a customer. Think, what does that really mean? So you look at Apple, I'd say, is such a nice example. All right. At Apple, whatever it was, 10, maybe 15 years ago now, said, hey, I bet there would be customers for a smartphone. And probably people said, well, if you asked the customer, they would have said, what's a smartphone? I don't need a smartphone. I don't even know what you're talking about. Have a nice day, right? But somehow everyone in the world, and I drive to, in Chatham, and I see the kids walking to school. They're all looking at their phones as they walk to school, Nobody even leaves the house without their phone anymore. So what they did was they created customers. So then I started thinking, okay, well, how can that concept apply to the real estate world? And that real estate world is partly, my law firm, it's partly clients, it's partly all different kinds of things. How do we, instead of just going to get customers or find deals or find investments or find clients from my firm, how do we create them? And you start thinking about it, and it really leads you in a very different direction, because where you have to go is something different than everyone else is doing. And then in any case, to sort of answer your question, hopefully not too long-windedly, the whole idea of the real estate philosopher is to either think of things myself or usually find people smarter than me, like the Peter Druckers of the world, and then think, well, what did they come up with? What brilliant insights did they have? And is there a way to apply that to the real estate world? And that's what I do in the real estate philosopher. I try to come up with ideas and angles that are different from what everyone else is saying. Because if it's just everyone else, maybe I've got a good idea, but I'm not really adding to the debate or the thought process. But I try to come up with things that are different. And if you do read the real estate philosopher's guide, you'll see all sorts of stuff that I'll bet no one's ever thought of before, that are either my perspectives or applying the perspectives of others to the real estate world.
So somewhere in your book, I expect to see, what is the purpose of opening an office building? It's to find a tenant. No, to create a tenant. I think I'm going to tweet today Peter Drucker in his statement that you just made. I think I'm going to tweet it today because people need to hear that. It's such reductionism. He just distills it right down to the real point and clarifies everybody's thinking. I like that a lot. So there you are with your book, helping to clarify people's thinking and think about things differently. So I'm not surprised that as a lawyer, you're writing, because as a journalist over the years, I've met so many lawyers who really had an interest in journalism, but they never made the switch over because they couldn't take the pay cut. But lawyers like to write. You guys write a lot anyway, but it's legalistic writing. And I think you guys love to break out of that. And but there's more to just the writing involved here. You're doing analysis of everything you're saying. You're getting philosophical about it. So what are some of the philosophical, let me put it this way first. You wrote the book. Why did you decide to actually write the book?
Why did I decide?
And the book just came out, in September, around September. So it's brand spanking new, available in everywhere.
I like to be helpful to people. And I'm not going to claim I'm, totally the most altruistic person on the planet, but I do like to be helpful to people. And, I've been writing these articles now. I think I started in 2015. So I've been writing this, for 6 years. And I find that, to make fun of myself, half the time I've forgotten the things I wrote 5 years ago. And I'm sure people who read whatever I wrote 5 years ago don't remember it either. And I've developed quite a following. A fair number of people really look forward to what I'm writing. And if I don't put out an article for a while, they'll email me or call me and say, hey, when's another article coming out? So it seemed like a good idea to put everything in one place. So that was sort of part of it. And then the other thing that I added, and what's really the book is, there's three parts. The beginning is really, I hate to call it a how-to book, but I guess it really is. It's kind of how to succeed in the real estate world, whether you're starting, like trying to get your first job, how should you do it? Or you're more sophisticated, how could you outperform? So that's the first part. And then the second part is basically all my articles. And then what I did to be helpful to people is for each article, I put a little lead in of like how you could actually use this article in your real estate business. And then finally, at the end, because you probably heard that saying, it's difficult to make predictions, especially about the future. So I foolishly put in my predictions for the future of the real estate world, especially, you know, with COVID floating around, you know, how would things happen? So the book is sort of how to, my articles, how to use them, and then my thoughts of what will happen in the future.
So let's talk a little bit about your predictions. So you were writing articles, you're writing this book during COVID. And so here you are making predictions at the most unpredictable time, and one of the most unpredictable times in U.S. history, very unpredictable right now, and maybe especially with regard to real estate, given that there's different property types like office buildings and hotels that really got slammed. So what are some of the predictions you have made?
So, you know, look, a lot of people predict things. You know, and you see it every day. And when they're right, you know, they shriek and wail and tell everybody how amazing they are. You know, I predicted the crash of 29, you know, and they're so proud of their predictions. And then when they're wrong, they tiptoe quietly away and hope nobody remembers that they were wrong. And I've tried not to do that. Okay. And I'm going to give you two, what I was right and one that I was wrong. All right. So one of them was when the world was crashing, this was, I guess, probably March, April, May of 2020. I think I was the first person to create the phrase big V recovery. I mean, they were talking about V recovery, but I came up with the phrase big V because I predicted that things, once they hit the bottom, were going to bash back incredibly fast. And I was right. Okay. And it did do exactly that. That was one of the ones I kind of nailed. And I remember when I did it, I was scared out of my mind because I was making this prediction into the face of like everyone's world falling apart. And there I was saying there's going to be a big V recovery. And the way I did my predicting, I tried not to let my emotions cloud my judgment because, like, you know, when it said like the headlines would be like retail sales fall 70%. I was thinking, well, what do you think happens when you close the stores? I mean, people can't buy anything, right? You know, so I was trying to use my brain power, and I was right on that. Another one I was right on was I said New York City is not over. I mean, people were saying, oh, everyone's going to leave New York. They're going to move to Florida. New York will die. You know, it'll probably even float into the ocean. And the article after article beating the heck out of how New York was finished. And I said the exact opposite. I said, absolutely not. Buy New York now was one of my headlines. I said, New York is not even remotely finished. People who've been betting against it for like 250 years have been wrong every time, and this is no exception. New York's already bounced back dramatically. The only place that hasn't yet is offices. But everything else in New York is already exploding, and all sorts of things are moving to the upside. So those were two I was right. And then here's one that I guess I also have to take credit for, is I was pretty sure that Amazon was a bubble that was going down. And I guess I've been slightly off by that when, you know, Amazon became worth, I think, almost $2 trillion. And Jeff Bezos, at least for a while, was the richest man in the world. So that one didn't go too well. There's a bunch of other predictions, like I predicted exactly what was going to happen with co-working and a bunch of other things. And I think overall, mostly my predictions have been correct. And once in a while, I blow it.
So the one about Amazon and Jeff Bezos, you were predicting they were going to go down. You mean during the pandemic, or was this years ago when you thought they'd never get profitable and they'd end up flaming out?
This was years ago. During the pandemic, I mean, no, that was – I basically – when Amazon bought Whole Foods, I said, this is their Waterloo. They'll never be able to do it. It won't work, yada, yada, yada. And I was just plain old wrong. They managed to make it work really well. And they're doing pretty well. And then obviously when COVID hit, it was an incredible boon for Amazon for obvious reasons, because their business model was enhanced and many others were hurt dramatically.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, you have been writing columns for some time. So I'm assuming that you've taken a lot of the information from these columns, repurposed them, rewritten, repurposed and whatnot, collected them together. I mean, some columnists literally will just put together, George Will has done it, Andrew Sullivan has done it, where they take a collection of their columns that are kind of, about the zeitgeist of the years that they were writing those columns and put them in a book. This is not that, but you are obviously, I would think, borrowing from past writing as well as introducing some of your more current thoughts. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Yes. And I think I am doing pretty close to what you said these other gentlemen and ladies have done, in that, the middle of the book is the actual text of all of my articles. And then it has a lead-in, which is new in the book, which explains how you could take that article and use it in your business, other than maybe the Amazon one, which I don't know, since I was just flat out wrong on. But otherwise, it does exactly what you're saying in the middle of the book.
I got it. Okay, so is there a particular column you've written or an article that you've integrated into the book that you feel like is the most meaningful, or one that you're especially proud of?
Yeah, most meaningful. I mean, it depends what day you ask me, which is most meaningful. But I think the one that has probably gotten the most intellectual capital, or people telling me, wow, that was really insightful, or something along those lines, was entitled, "You Will Never Find Another Good Deal Again." And what did I mean by that? So if you think about what a lot of people do, especially the parties that are investing, they're sitting in front of a computer screen and a deal gets sent to them by a broker, let's say, and it's a deal to buy a building for $100 million. And they look at it and they analyze it and they try to figure out if it's a good thing to buy. And my point was, if that's what you're doing, the absolute best you will ever do is average performance. Because if you start thinking about it, how many people are seeing that? 100, 1,000, I don't know, maybe more. They're all looking at the exact same screen. And you think that you're smarter or luckier than everyone else, and you're going to see something on that screen that nobody else saw, which will allow you to bid a little bit more than the highest bidder, but still be able to really clean up somehow on that deal that everyone else saw. Not only that, you think you'll be able to do that again and again and again. And I would say that's ludicrous. The chances that you could do that are basically below zero. They're zero. So the point is, you're never going to find another great deal again. What you have to do instead is create a deal. And there's all different ways to do that. But one way or another, you have to create intellectual capital that will be able for deals to be created rather than found. And I remember a lot of people responded to me saying, boy, is that right? Because they're realizing that the old way of just looking at stuff doesn't work. The last thing I'll say on that is this: that was the old way. There was a reason it used to work. The old days, before really information on real estate was fairly ubiquitous and everything was kind of instantaneously given out to everyone, there wasn't a ton of information. So somebody was trying to sell a building and you might be looking at it. There weren't that many other people looking at it. And you could kind of nose the bait and look around and, think about it. And you were, in a way, creating value by doing that. But once information becomes so ubiquitous, you lose that. And now you really got to use your brain power to figure out a different way of doing business than just looking at the screen at what comes to you.
So being that you've been in real estate law for what, about 30 years, so you've seen some tremendous changes in real estate, in the real estate industry, the professionalization of the industry, now we're in the era of big data. There's automation that's being brought to buildings, buildings run on computers rather than using people in the numbers that they used to. So how much does that play into the book at all? Just the how real estate has changed the way it has, and that and really when you look at where we're going. I mean, we've written articles in our magazines about, you know, intelligent buildings, the intelligent buildings of the future, and just how amazing they're you know, bound to be over time. It's just a question of, you know, what the timeline is. How much do you devote to that, or how much time do you spend philosophizing about that? And since you make predictions, you might also be making predictions about that.
So one thing, I remember my my philosophy teacher in college telling me, he said, Bruce, and he meant this as a compliment, Bruce, you have an uncanny grasp of things you don't know. And he did mean it as a compliment, because really the first step to trying to know something is realizing what you don't know. I don't know anything at all about, how a building gets automated or run. You know, I go in and I switch on the light, and if the air conditioning isn't working, I call someone and say, hey, the AC isn't working. So I know my limitations. That's not something that I would write on, because I'm probably, you know, a very weak in that area. However, in terms of the way real estate is morphing, I think I've been seeing one of the articles is real estate becoming effectively almost a service rather than a thing, you know, if you will. And we've seen that with like co-living, co-working, and all different ways that buildings are being broken up ownership-wise. And people are being more and more creative. I think there's actually a plan some parties now have to go public with one building, which could become a whole transformation. You've got crowdfunding. You've got all these different things happening as the real estate world becomes, I hate the word disrupted, but disrupted. Some of the disruption is the stuff that you were talking about that I just don't add any value on. I don't really understand it. And I don't try to understand it, because it would be just too much catch up for me. And then the other part is really the structuring and that area. And that is also proceeding apace. And it's kind of cool, because real estate was, I guess the word was stodgy for a long time. I mean, it was still fun and everything, but it really hadn't changed probably in like 1,000 years. And all of a sudden, so much going on, so many different players, so many doing so many different things. And one thing that is not happening is you may think like, well, the big old players are, you know, behind, and it's the smart little ones. It's actually not true. You've got major players like RXR with a prop tech portfolio. You've got all different players doing different things. And some of the biggest players are at the cutting edge, trying to take technology and building automation and things like that and trying them out in their buildings. So it's incredibly exciting moment to be in real estate. The only thing you're wrong about is it's now close to 40 years rather than 30 that I've been in the game.
Is that right? Okay, so you mentioned co-living and co-officing and so on, the WeWork kind of model. We just did a podcast a couple days ago about co-warehousing. That's another place where this model is being implemented, so the smaller businesses and companies have available warehouse space and flexibility that they need. So let me ask you a question about your law firm for a minute. I'm just curious, do you still have law books on the shelves, or are those entirely gone and it's all, obviously the stuff you're using now is computerized, but or do you keep the law books just for ambiance, or have you gotten rid of them completely?
it's a good question. And maybe the answer will surprise you. Real estate has very little law. Okay. I mean, you know, some areas like securities law, you know, there's or litigation, you know, there's the rules of practice and procedure and securities. There's like a zillion, you know, things that you have to know to be a competent lawyer. Real estate law, when you really think about it, is what you write down. So if I'm buying a building from you, okay, we do a contract, a purchase and sale agreement. That purchase and sale agreement says something like, you promise to sell me the building on this date and I'll pay you this much money. And this is what happens if there's a title problem, and on and on and on. And whatever we write down is generally the law, meaning the law will enforce the contract that we write. I mean, different states are, you know, a little bit looser around the edges on that, but that's generally how it works. So when you really become a real estate lawyer, what you become proficient in is drafting a contract or agreement or whatever it happens to be that is clear and not able to be challenged as vague or incorrect, rather than memorizing or learning a whole pile of laws that apply. Now, having said that, some of the things that are happening, like when, say, real estate goes public or whatnot, then there's a ton of laws that apply to it. But basic, you know, meat and potatoes real estate, there aren't a lot of books written on it. Now, answering your question, yes, I used to have some on the shelf, and I think there's some there. And being really, really honest, they probably are gathering dust, or more than gathering dust, they're probably coated in dust because I haven't really looked at them in God knows how many years.
So, so you don't have the big array of books that the general law firms do. You never had it quite like that. But now let me ask you, you're talking about making predictions. Does the book include a prediction about whether office real estate will come back? And if so, in what form will it come back? Because most people are figuring, there's so much talk about hybrid, the kind of hybrid model of using offices. What's your prediction as to, will office come back? In what form? And is the footprint going to shrink per client just because you split shift type stuff and all that? What do you think?
If
it's not in the book, just go ahead and make a wild prediction anyway.
Oh, it's all over the book, and my neck is stuck way, way, way out. And there's even a little picture graph I drew, and I can't really draw, but I drew a little graph. So basically what I'm saying, and I'll try to do it in a pictorial way, even though we're on audio here. So the whole idea of kind of like work from home or whatever you will, that's something that's been percolating around for like, I don't know, 20 or 30, maybe even 100 years. I don't know. Well, it might have been 100 years because they didn't have a telephone. But the whole idea has been there for a long time, and it's been growing little by little, okay? And then what happens? Well, COVID hits, and of course it changes from growing a little to almost 100%. Almost everybody works at home for a while. And then the question is, well, what's going to happen? My prediction is that the trend, the long-term trend of people gradually working from home will continue as it has been, and it'll gradually grow over time. In terms of the explosion of people working at home for COVID, I believe that as soon as people decide COVID is over, and I understand that's a loaded question, as you know, now we have a Omicron to add to Delta, to add to this, to add to the other thing. But at some point, I believe that, you know, the world will decide that there is a way to deal with COVID in our daily lives. At that point, I believe the coming back to the office will be extremely robust, and in fact, office will boom again. And I have all sorts of reasons that I've written in my articles, but I'll just give you the example of my office. Okay, we said everybody needs to come back after Labor Day, and we didn't beat everybody up if people had a reason not to be there. You know, we were very lenient. But what we found, actually to our surprise, actually, I don't know if it was a surprise or not, but what we found is that everybody wanted to come back. And you know why? People like each other. We have a really nice place to work, and you get to see your friends. And, you know, sitting home alone, you know, sure, there's times you like to sit home alone and work, and it's calm and it's quiet, and you're in your underwear or the Speedo you were mentioning before, and you're just typing things out. And there's a certain niceness to that. But we found that most people don't want to do that every day. They want to be back. And the reason they want to be back, the biggest reason, is that's where their friends are. That's where their clients are. That's where the people that are doing things are. And it's kind of fun. So I would say, and this is a little tongue-in-cheek, that if your office situation is like from hell, and it's a horrible place with evil, horrible people, you know, like some sort of TV show, those people probably want to stay working from home. But if your business is doing something of value, and it's exciting to be there, and you have friends and colleagues who you respect, people want to come back. That's where the action is. That's where the excitement is. Anyway, my neck is stuck way, way out in predicting that office will be just fine and even more robust than before. But there's still, I guess, more of a waiting period, you know, because of the virus continues to have the world in its thrall.
You know, just to add to what you said, the company that I used to work for called American City Business Journals used to use the Gallup organization. People think of Gallup as, you know, they do polling. Surveys, but what they also do is management survey. They do management consulting. They come in and they give questionnaires to all the employees. And the company wanted to make sure all the employees were happy and understand where they were at. And one of the survey questions was, I have a best friend at work. And that was like a true or false question. I believe it was a true or false question. And we used to kind of mock that question and say, it's such a silly question. And then we had a gathering. The management people had a gathering with people from the Gallup organization. We brought that up. It's like, isn't this just a silly question? They said, you know what? That is the single most predictive question as to whether a person will stay with a company or leave. So if you're talking about retention, you want people to have friends at the office, somebody they consider good, a good friend or good friends at the office. And not only it does that bring, as you're saying, Bruce, you're saying that's going to bring people back because their friends are there, but it also leads to retention for a company or a firm or what have you. So there is that connectedness. I mean, it's your prediction, I think, resonates and it makes sense. Now, you don't just do predictions, though. You
Go right ahead. Let me interrupt just for a second to resonate what you're saying. There's a book, and I think there's even an article I wrote on it years ago in the book, in my book. I just don't remember. There's a book called Let's First Break All the Rules, okay? And one of the things in the book is this Gallup poll where they talk about 12 questions that are designed to determine the likelihood of employee attrition. And one of them is exactly that. Do you have a best friend at work? The first one is, do I get to do what I do best every day at work? Do I have the tools I need to do a good job? Are my colleagues committed to doing good work? Is my work important to the company? And do I have a best friend at work, et cetera? There's 12 questions, and it's astonishing, according to the analysis of it, that if these questions are mostly answered in the yes or affirmative, the attrition is dramatically lower than the other way around. Mm-hmm. And the thing I found really interesting in the book, by the way, even though we're talking about my book, I definitely recommend, this is one of the best business books ever. The thing that was interesting, most interesting to me, that I was a manager of my firm for many years, was the boss, let's say the boss of the company, you know, wants morale to be good. And so he's out there and he's like, you know, they get the weekends to do this. They get Fridays off. They get, free lunches. They get this. He's just doing all these things. But for some reason, people are still miserable and quitting. Okay. And the reason is because your direct supervisor, am I allowed to say asshole? All right. Well, I just did. So your direct supervisor is an asshole. And the boss is a wonderful guy. You go in every day to work and you work for an asshole. And the fact that the boss is out there doing all these wonderful things doesn't mean anything to you. Or the other way around. The boss of the company is an asshole, but your direct supervisor loves you and is looking out for you and he's commiserating. He's doing everything he can to make your life okay, even though the boss is the asshole. You stick around. And I was like, that's why this book was so good. It opened my mind to so many things. And that's why I wrote an article on it. So I was realizing, if I want my law firm to be successful, hopefully I'm not going to be the asshole as the boss. I pray I wasn't. But it's going to be much more meaningful if I can figure out how to enable the people who are directly supervising others to treat others in the right way. And then, there'll be, love or whatever you want to call it throughout the organization. Anyway, it's a great book. I'm sorry to interrupt what you were saying.
No, not at all. I'm familiar with the book. And, when you were reading off those questions, they are still so fresh in my mind. I mean, I completely remember the questions that you had read off there. And, the other thing is that Gallup preaches, and I believe it was the founder of Gallup who wrote a book called Soar With Your Strengths. So there, you're familiar with that. So you know that one of the mistakes people make is they look at their weaknesses and they decide, I'm going to strengthen my weaknesses. I'm going to turn them from weaknesses to strengths. When in reality, because of who you are, those probably will never really be strengths. So they talk about amplifying your strengths or continuing to build on your strengths and managing your weaknesses. So one of the guys with Gallup had said, so as an example, if I want to be a sprinter, but I'm a big guy and really built for strength, not speed, I can go out there and do sprints every day and get coached doing sprints, and I'll probably improve a little bit, but I'm never going to be a great sprinter. But boy, can I throw a discus or a shot put. So why don't I spend my time focused on doing something that's actually going to show real progress that I can be really good at, rather than frustrating myself and spend that time on things that I'm never going to really be great at, because that's just not who I am. So it's really a book focused on, you know, everybody's got certain strengths. Everybody's got skills. That's one of the points they make. Everybody's got talents. It's just that they're not all recognized as talents. So develop the talents, manage the weaknesses, and your career will be much better that way. So,
Mike, I want to compliment.
Go right ahead.
I think you should be a philosopher yourself. I did read that book. It's called Soar with Your Strengths. It's great, and you are absolutely correct in what you're saying, at least in my view. If you're good at something, you should get greater and greater till you can kind of crush it. And yeah, manage your weaknesses, but you're spot on there.
Yeah, you know, and really, if you think about it, I'll use a football analogy just because, or example, because there's a lot of people who are football fans. You take a look at a guy like Bill Belichick, who many regard as the greatest football coach ever. Bill Parcells was a great football coach. Bill Parcells was on 60 Minutes being interviewed, and he admitted that, look, I'm very narrow. I don't really know a lot about anything. He says, but I'm very deep on football. And he says, I'm not proud of being that narrow. But it was an example of he poured everything into what he was good at, and he became a Super Bowl champion. Coached a team to, I think, a couple Super Bowl championships. And so just as an example, you narrow the focus. And I remember an artist who had said this to my wife. He said, well, what kind of art are you doing? And she says, oh, this, that, the other thing. And he goes, you're going to go nuts. And he says, you can't, you're spreading yourself too thin. He said, what you do is you focus on something, and you focus on it intensely, and it expands. That's what you need to do. He says, and then you can think about maybe creating that kind of aptitude or skill with other forms of art. But you got to pick something to focus on and expand it. Otherwise, you're going to spread yourself all over the place, and you'll never really develop those other art forms, any of those art forms. So I want to get to inspiration, but I also want to give you a chance to respond to that if you wanted to piggyback on that one, Bruce.
Oh boy, is that a fat pitch over the plate. I totally, totally, totally agree. My prior book was If You Want to Get Rich, Build a Power Niche, a phrase I had actually created, the whole idea of a power niche. But, you know, it comes from the people smarter than me, as a lot of things do. But the whole theory of being successful at something is picking a narrow area, a niche, if you will. And I misspoke. The key to success is creating a narrow niche that you can own and then grow it. And you sort of have a monopoly power in your niche. I'm not going to say that I have a monopoly power on real estate knowledge or something. That would be ridiculous. But I did create the real estate philosopher. It is unique. The reason you're interviewing me is like, what the heck's a real estate philosopher? I've never seen one of them before. And there's something interesting about it. And it's grown. A lot of people have wondered about it, and it's stimulated, whatever it is. But I very, very, very strongly agree. And your artist friend or friend of friend, if she or he is all over the place, the odds are statistically lower than if that artist picks something to do that is kind of unique. And it's interesting, this is a silly little thing, but my wife and I, we collect pigs, not live ones, although I wanted to get one, she nixed that. But, you know, it pigs all over the house. And so, you know, it turns out that there's an artist that like paints pigs. She's really good at painting pigs. That's her thing. So sure enough, I've already bought two paintings from her, and we'll probably buy a whole bunch more. But the thing is, she paints pigs. That's her thing. And you might say, what a ridiculous idea on the one hand. On the other hand, I never would have bought a painting from her or heard of her or anything to do with her if she hadn't narrowed her focus to painting pigs. All right, enough on that. Back to you.
Well, there's some kind of harmonic convergence going on here, Bruce, because the guy I'm talking about, that artist who tried to school my wife, he is called Frogman. And he does frogs, and he does geckos as well, and they're beautiful, and they are solid. They're metal, and they're beautifully painted, and they've got this great patina on them. And you pick that thing up, and you just feel that it's solid state, It's a real piece of work, and they're beautifully rendered. And when we first met him, he was at one of those street fairs. And years later, he was being invited to art galleries. I mean, this is how successful he got. Following his own advice, he ended up getting invited to art galleries and all. He's making, you know, just a motherload of money selling. And people collect these. Mm-hmm. I've got one in my home. People collect these. And it's another example of synchronicity here. So so what about inspiration? You've got inspiration as part of your real estate philosophy in the book. I'm going to take a guess that with COVID going on and a lot of downcast people, you may have tried to inspire them a little bit because you foresaw that, hey, we're a very resilient people. We innovate, we do what we need to do, and we've been through everything from major world wars to financial collapses, and we come back stronger every time.
Okay, I'm going to read you something. There is a movie called Catch Me If You Can, and I'm spacing the name.
Oh, I love that movie.
Yeah,
I love that movie. Thing.
But there's a story the guy tells in the spacing the name of the actor too is the strange old guy, the father. He says something like this. He says, and I'm going to try to sound like him, but now you're going to really make fun of me. Two little mice fell into a bucket of cream. The first mouse quickly gave up and drowned. The second mouse, he wouldn't quit. He struggled so hard that eventually he turned that cream into butter and crawled out. Gentlemen, as of this moment, I am that second mouse. His name in the movie was Frank Abagnale Sr. And the whole idea of the second mouse inspired me to write an article of inspiration to tell everybody, be the second mouse during COVID. When things are going crazy and wrong, come up with a different way of doing things that might work. So like at the time, remember this is a year and a half ago, like some hotels started offering 14-day quarantine packages. Another one, to sort of make lemonade out of lemons. All sorts of people came up with crazy ideas, to turn a horrible disaster into something that might actually not be so bad. And so the inspiration was trying to do is say, don't give up. Try to be that second mouse. Kick up the cream. The other inspiration article I wrote, which was, from the heart, was about your reputation. It's easy to have a great reputation when times are good. You're making tons of money. Everything's awesome. But how about when things are really falling apart? That's when reputations are really tested, and that's what really separates the people that really try so hard to be honorable and wonderful and people respect from those that, kind of give in and go to the dark side. And I actually quoted one of my clients. I won't embarrass them, but I remember meeting with them the first time when I pitched them, and the guy, I met said to me, what did he say? His exact words, and I have it in front of me. He said to me, "Bruce, our reputation is everything." And I was like, okay, a lot of people say things like that. And then when I came back for a second meeting with other people, the guy I met said, "Bruce, our reputation is everything." And then when we finally got work from this client and they started working with us, the first deal, the first meeting, they said, "Bruce, our reputation is everything." And it was clear, like, that was something that they cared about so much that they would look like a class act and be a class act no matter what happened. And sure, they wanted to make money in their incredibly successful organization, but that was something that meant so much to them. And I try to do that myself, and I pray that I pull that off, and my firm has. And I love my clients when they do things that are impressive, especially when things fall apart.
I love that cream story, turning the cream to butter, because, turning lemons into lemonade is so hackneyed. This one's much fresher. It's much, much better. And I think most people like cream and butter better than lemonade anyway. So, Bruce, one of the things you write about is advice to someone getting his or her first job in real estate. Talk about that.
So just to cut right to it on that, it's a question I'm asked, many, many times. Usually it's my friend's daughter or son is, trying to get a job in the real estate. And, how can I either advise them or help them? And so, you know, it's very simple. In a nutshell, your first job, if you can get it, should be at the most prestigious real estate company in the biggest city possible. Yes, that's New York City in the U.S. It is, you know, the financial center and certainly an awful lot going on in the real estate world. So my advice to somebody trying to get their first job is look for the most prestigious organization in real estate in New York City. That's the first thing. And the reason is very, you know, kind of analytical. You know, the odds are your first job will not be your final job. You know, almost everyone ends up changing jobs in a career. It's so easy to go from super cool organization in New York City to almost anywhere else, but it's awfully hard, not to denigrate any other place in the country, but it's very difficult if you're at a smaller player in a smaller city to go the other direction. It's just, your resume just isn't have much pizzazz in it. So that would be the first thing I would say. Second thing I would say to somebody starting a new job is try to find a place where you're going to learn a lot. You know, if you can, people, an organization that's doing cutting edge work, difficult work, whether it's on the debt side, the development side, the joint venture side, the investment side, it doesn't even matter. But a place that's doing cutting edge, difficult stuff that makes your brain blast out of its skull trying to figure out what in God's name is going on. Because this is really the intellectual capital that spices out your career. And then the third piece, because there's really only three, try to find a place where you're going to meet other players in the game. Okay. You know, if you're in real estate, you know, you want to meet other real estate people. You don't know what's going to happen, you know, as you meet people. But there's that old saying, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And the older you get, the more you realize, God, is that true? And I wish somebody like Bruce on this call with Mike had told me this, you know, 40 years ago. Go to a place where you're hopefully going to meet a zillion players in the real estate game that are in your industry. And then try to keep in contact with them. And who knows what will happen. But 20 years later, the odds are real high that a bunch of those people you met early on will be significant players, people you know, people you were in the trenches with back when everything stunk and you were just, you know, at the water cooler at midnight crying or whatever. Those are the people who are going to be shaping the city that you're in and will be your friends. So those are the three things. It's the most prestigious thing, place possible in the biggest city, place where you're going to learn a ton on cutting edge, intellectually stimulating work. And then thirdly, a place where you're going to meet a ton of players in the real estate game.
I don't think anybody would dispute that kind of advice. So you also talk about outperforming with real estate. You got a bunch of tips for that. How do you outperform with real estate assets? So why don't you highlight at least a few of them? What are some of the high notes you could offer?
You know, I've written a lot on this, and you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to actually go to one of my articles. I actually came up with the don't do's. So instead of what to do, don't do these. And then, I don't know, I mean, I'm being enigmatic, but there's like so much about how to outperform in my book. So I'll whip through them real fast. First, don't let animal spirits change your underwriting. Stick to what you know. To clients that tell me mournfully, Bruce, I haven't done a deal in a year. You know, that's not necessarily a bad thing because there's nothing worse than doing a bad deal. Second, don't try to time the market. You can't do it. You just can't. You may think you can, and maybe you get lucky for a while. But if you're going to do long-term value creation, trying to time the market is the opposite way to do it. The clients that I see cleaning up, doing fantastically, they basically say something like, well, you know, sometimes I get a tailwind from cap rate compression and my valuations go up and sometimes it goes the other way and I get whacked. So I ignore that. I ignore the market. I just look for good deals. And if I find a deal that hits my underwriting, I do it. In the short run, I may get hurt, but in the long run, I'm going to outperform everyone. Third, avoid high overhead. We have a saying at our firm, low overhead is great, because the problem with high overhead, it shoves you into doing things that you really shouldn't be wanting to do. Another one, I don't know what number I'm up to, is don't go to different geographies if you can't find deals in your current one. Warren Buffett has an admonition. He's so quotable. He says, if you can't run your own business successfully, it doesn't make sense then to enter a new business that you know nothing about. I mean, think about it. You know, you can't find deals in New York, so you go to Nashville. I mean, you know nothing about Nashville. You're the sucker in the poker game, as Warren Buffett would say. When you go to Nashville and you're playing the game against all these people who spent their whole lives in Nashville, know every nook and cranny, and you're some fool from New York that said, I can't find deals in New York. I'm going to Nashville. So I don't like that one. The don't hunker down when times are bad, because that's just timing the market. When COVID hits or when the global financial crisis, it is not a time to hunker down. It's a time to continue doing exactly what you always did, which is look for good deals. I already mentioned this earlier in our call, but don't sit around and let brokers create the value. You be the one who creates the deals rather than tries to find them. And let's see, I'll give you one more. This one is from Michael. Actually, I don't know if it was Michael Porter exactly, but it's his view generally. Michael Porter is sort of the father of, you know, of competitive advantages. But there's a view in a book I read, which is three words, which is so powerful. Competition is evil. It's so beautiful, isn't it? If you can avoid competing, try instead, in Michael Porter's words, to be different. Try to not do what everyone else is doing. And it's really hard because everyone else is doing it. So try to figure out some way to be doing something that's different. And of course, you got a chance. It might not be good. It might go bad, actually. But if you want to outperform, the first thing you got to do is be different.
And I'll add one of my own. Don't expand your definition of core real estate. Well, pretty soon the shanty down the street's going to start looking like core real estate and you're going to waste your money. You know, people raise a bunch of money. They got to put it to work. And, oh, you know, that shanty's core real estate, don't you think? I mean, everything is going so well. I've seen the price going up over there. People make that mistake too. And as an economy gets stronger, or real estate, you know, especially after a correction or a you know, a big disaster like the global financial crisis, I think people need to be very careful because the comeback happens and then everything gets expensive. And then it's like, well, that one over there is core too, don't you think? Let's just buy it or at least take a piece of it. Bruce Statchenfeld, everybody. The book is called The Real Estate Philosopher's Guide. And you have just gotten a sample of it. And you've even gotten book recommendations from Bruce. So you know, he's not going to compete. He's not afraid of these other books because his book is different. So he's not worried about that. He's taking his own advice, his own philosophical input is being turned into output right now. So Bruce, I'm going to advise you to go back to the pool with your pen and paper, start cogitating and working on book number two, because people are going to, you know, read this current book and they're going to want an encore performance. So. And don't be a stranger. I think that maybe we can get you to write something in the magazine and maybe have a encore performance on a future podcast. I really appreciate you taking the time and will tell you that this exceeded my expectations. I thought we were going to have a nice 20-minute conversation, 30-minute. We're coming up on an hour. It's been very good. Appreciate your time.
Well, Michael, thank you for the compliments. Thank you for having me. I'd love to write an article and I'll compliment you. And I know this sounds self-serving and it's true. You're very, very good at this because what you do is you kind of, you don't just ask me questions. You really add to the conversation in a way that kind of gets the person being interviewed, me, to really open up on things. So hats off to you.
I try to be additive. I always try to be additive.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, you really do, and it's very impressive. And I've been interviewed by a lot of people, so hats off to you, and thank you for having me.
This podcast has been sponsored by Juniper Square. Juniper Square is transforming the private capital markets industry with solutions and services that streamline fundraising, investment operations, and investor reporting. Designed for commercial real estate, Juniper Square is trusted by hundreds of investment sponsors to manage more than $1 trillion in real estate investments. Reach Juniper Square at junipersquare.com.